You're listening to a 4x4 Radio Network podcast.
The Center Steer Podcast, a Land Rover podcast by Land Rover owners. Welcome to the 34th edition of the Center Steer Podcast. I am your host here, John Costage, from wonderful North Huntingdon, Pennsylvania, near Pittsburgh. Today is unseasonably warm for the last day of January 2000.
Freakishly warm.
It's like 60 degrees
Fahrenheit.
62. Is it 62 Fahrenheit?
Well, growing up as a kid in Minnesota, this would have been 100 degrees warmer than a typical weekend this time of year.
Last weekend here in this area, I got 8 inches of snow, while D.C. got a foot and a half.
I had a foot.
Did you?
Yeah.
And you're okay. Yeah, you don't live too far away from me either. But we had 8 inches. But now it's almost all gone. Joining me in the studio today is...
I'm Harold.
And
Dave Carroll.
Dave, what did you drive today?
I drove my 2015 Ram instead of my Discovery.
Your brand new Dodge Ram diesel.
Yes.
Very nice. We'll hear about that
a little
later.
I love a truck that comes with instructions. On the side, it says Ram. On the front, it says Dodge.
No. Mine says Ram everywhere.
Oh, well played. I hadn't heard that one before. That's good. All the way from Vermont.
Hey, I'm Morgan. It's been unseasonably warm here as well. We actually didn't get really any of your snow.
No, because it came up. Came from the south, and
yeah, we got a couple inches. That was it. And even today, it's like 50 degrees out.
Well, there you go. The Green Mountain State.
Yeah, still green.
I'm sorry to hear that.
and still mountainous.
And our guest today is Craig Dutton. Craig is a South African who currently is in Europe. Say hi, Craig.
Hey, how you guys doing?
Good. Welcome to the show, and thanks for joining us.
Yes, absolute pleasure.
Do you mind revealing where you are? Are you?
So, not at all. I'm currently sitting in Ireland. I will be here for another week or so, and then I am heading off to Scotland hunting down Land Rovers.
And you are the, organizer, producer of My Land Rover Has a Soul.
Yeah. So I'm the photographer, really, that kind of started My Land Rover Has a Soul. And I am also the organizer of the Landy Festival in South Africa, which was the baby child of My Land Rover Has a Soul.
And that is all a teaser, because you got to listen to more of the show till we actually talk to Craig, and we'll talk more about that. Was that a good teaser? Did we do well?
Perfect.
We don't usually plan the teaser, so that was I'm very excited about
it. I'm feeling sufficiently teased.
Yes.
I think that's a good opportunity to move into the news. and Craig, as always, we like our guests to participate. So at any time, add in your thoughts and your ideas. I do want to know before we get started, what do you drive?
I'm driving a P38 Range Rover diesel.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, it's nice. My favorite little car.
Excellent. Did you say little car?
Yeah.
I never thought P38s were that little.
That's actually not little.
Well, certainly not in terms of the headaches they cause.
Yeah, it's true.
You're right.
Yes.
Yeah, they are high maintenance.
But if you get one that's good, you know.
Get what?
If you get one that's good.
Get one that's what?
Yeah, well, there's got to be a few out there, right?
So
when they left the factory, maybe.
Automobile sales in the United States for 2015 were a record. 17.4 million brand new vehicles were sold over the course of the year. That barely beats the previous record in the year 2000. So 17.4 million brand new vehicles sold in the United States. And it's nice to say that Land Rover was at the top of the list thanks to excellent sales of SUVs, crossovers, and trucks. Land Rover was up. This is December to December, so between December 14 and December 15, Land Rover sales were up 46.7%. Volvo was up almost 90%, and Jeep was right below Land Rover at 42%. Little side note, Bentley was up 41%. Unfortunately, towards the bottom, Jaguar was down 28%. And just in hard numbers, Land Rover sold 8,441 vehicles here in the United States in December 15, and they sold 5,754 units December of 14. Overall, it helped JLR up 29.6%. So as a company, they were the best company for December in sales, as percentage of increase in sales.
Apparently on the backs of the Land Rover portion of the company.
Clearly, yeah. Jag sold 1,200 units compared to Land Rover's 8,400 units.
Hey, they beat out Smart, so...
Yeah, you're right. Smart was at 669.
Yeah.
I don't think they're supporting that anymore. That was a Mercedes joint, wasn't it?
I got to say, it makes no sense in this country to own one of those things.
It made sense if it was a city that and you only went around in a city like New York. And
right,
where
you have a lot of congestion and a need to park something really tiny.
Yes.
Because the cost of it relative to the economy, it didn't make sense. I mean, you could get something twice as big with the same or better fuel economy for the same money.
And then I also think Zipcar and an Uber and Lyft have all probably made that even less of a need to have that small car, even if it was small and cheaper to operate. But
right,
now
because you can just not own a car relative to owning one small enough to get around town. You just don't have to own one.
And further news... So last month, I believe, was the first full month for diesels by Land Rover here in the U.S., and I found some specific numbers, and I thought we'd share those. Land Rover sold 417 Range Rover Sport diesels, and they sold 387 Range Rover diesels, just the full Range Rover diesels. And that was, again, for December 15. As a comparison, and this is just by units, right above them was the Grand Cherokee diesel, 420 units, so the Range Rover Sport almost beat that. However, didn't come close, and Dave helped out. The number one truck diesel sale in the U.S. was coming in at 4,531 units, the Ram pickup. Thanks for helping out, Dave.
Yeah, well.
Well, that diesel makes a lot of sense in a big truck.
Indeed.
Well, they're selling diesels in their half-ton line now, too.
And that's helping their numbers, definitely, because you used to have to buy a three-quarter or bigger to get one.
Well, but it's a different diesel. Yeah. It's a 3-liter that they've purchased from Mercedes, I believe.
Oh, really?
Yeah. The same 3-liter that you get in, like, the ML and the GL.
Mm. Well, it's still rather good.
How long has the Jeep diesel been on the market for, then?
The Grand Cherokee, I don't think that's been out.
I think
that
that's this
long.
Year.
I think that was this
and
year.
And that's the same diesel that they're putting in the Ram 1500 too,
which makes sense because they're the same manufacturer. Yeah,
right.
Yeah, they've. I know Jeep is increasing the number of models that have diesels.
Yeah,
it's interesting they'd buy that engine and not use a Fiat.
Well, they're buying the Cummins for the bigger trucks.
Well, yeah, but they have access to a good small diesel in the Fiat. Why wouldn't they use that?
I bet you they started development before
it's
they
Fiat
got sold.
And good.
And they might have had might have been part of the deal too. You know, when they got sold off to what ended up being Fiat, maybe Mercedes already had their hook in because remember they used to
own could be.
A lot of that stuff. Because it takes usually five, 6 years in a development cycle.
Right.
That's a good question. So Land Rover seems to be going strong. Just to refer you back to the numbers of that they sold in total units. So I remind you that in December, Land Rover sold 8,441 units. And the diesels, when you add it up between the Range Rover and the Range Rover Sport, was about 900 units.
About 11%.
About 11%. There's you doing the math. And
more or less.
So I think, a strong, good start, especially considering, Volkswagen's having its issues, and they didn't sell any diesels.
They're on hiatus.
I'm sorry, Craig?
That's it already. That's quite funny.
Yeah. I own one, too. That's interesting. Yeah.
Not everyone's perfect.
That's true.
Well, in this country, the number of choices for a small car with a diesel engine are pretty slim.
Really,
and it really is a good engine, despite the legal trouble they're in. I still stand behind the engine as being a good design.
Well, it's not, but even the problem is not the engine; it's the exhaust.
It's the emissions control system, which is always
It's always there. It's always an issue. Yeah.
Well, that's the thing. Back in South Africa, VW diesels they've been out for a decade, and they really are great motors. And we don't really give a rat's about emissions down that side of the world. So, this whole nonsense didn't really affect the South Africans as much as what it affected you guys in the first world.
Well, and it's less the actual emission issue. I think it's more the fact that they lied about it, because they said it's fine, it's taken care of, and it's the
maneuvering and the deception that's the real problem.
I think that's
the reality of it is the system they designed. It really is a pretty elegant system, and it did the job when it was allowed to operate. It's the fact that they kept turning it off that's the real issue.
Right. Yeah. Yep. So it's really kind of down to the lying and the cheating, really.
Yeah.
And they knew about it. It's not even like they cheated for a year or two while they try to fix it. It was, well, I've been doing this for 6 years. Let's keep going.
But the end result is it's eroded consumer confidence.
Mm-hmm. Indeed. And I also miss out on, they were just bringing the four-wheel drive version of the Jetta to the market. And it was like, that would have been killer. Four-wheel drive, sport wagon, TDI. Oh.
But. Yeah, except that it would slowed the car down. That's the only issue I have with it. That all-wheel drive soaks up a lot of horsepower.
Yeah. Okay.
It would have been cool.
It would have been. I would have liked to find out.
Because I could, we could have done a lifted version. And
along the lines of the diesels, the BBC Auto section did a review of the Range Rover TD6 and the Sport TD6. And the headline, which you'll see in the show notes, is called "Can Land Rover Redeem the Diesel?" Which to me is kind of a misnomer, because the article is just really a review of the North American version of the diesels. And
that's a headline sounds to me like a head tilt towards the Volkswagen scandal.
Clearly, yeah, it was to bring people in. But they if you read it, they really liked it. It was good. It was quiet. All the things we've talked about and heard about before. And they've
all the reasons for buying a Volkswagen 5 years ago.
Indeed, and they referenced that
smooth, quiet, powerful.
And they
economical.
They referenced that here by talking about the emissions, and Land Rover. Is quick to note that a diesel engine. TD6 is admirably clean. A low pressure exhaust gas recirculation system reduces the volume of toxic gases produced during combustion, and exhaust gas urea injection breaks down the NOx emissions into harmless nitrogen and water. So, which is what VW was supposed to do, I suppose.
That's what they all do.
Yeah. And VW, well, they turn it on and off, right?
Well, yeah. Well, Volkswagen had come up with a way to not have to use the diesel exhaust fluid, which I like the notion of that. It's just I think the reality of why they turned it on and off was for longevity. I think the system worked, but maybe it wouldn't have lasted the 100,000 miles.
Mm, okay. For comparison to Dave's Ram, the TD6 gets a combined cycle of 28 miles. Oh, I'm sorry, 28 miles on the highway and 25 miles per gallon combined. So there you go.
And it tows how much?
I don't know if they mentioned towing here.
Yeah.
But it does have...
865 foot-pounds of torque.
In stock trim.
In stock, yes. Stock, without
this has
tweaking it or...
This has 443 pound-feet of torque.
That is impressive.
That is good for a small engine.
So for perspective, I can tell you that our friend Bob, who owns the Ford Raptor, it has 410 horsepower and 435 foot-pounds of torque.
Well, that's a gasoline engine.
That's a gas engine. So,
well, and this diesel, they even compare it to the V8, the Range Rover V8, and they said it's 18 pound-feet less than the 5-liter supercharged V8. So the TD6 compared to the supercharged.
And twice the fuel economy.
And probably,
at least.
Probably, the 3 liter. I don't think they have the fuel economy in that one. But
yeah, if you have to ask.
Well, it's a Range Rover, too,
if you have to ask.
It's a Range Rover Discovery.
Yeah.
Sorry. Uh-huh. Oh, that's coming up. We didn't talk about that story yet. We will.
Wait for it.
Wait for it, yeah. All right. So that is it's diesels, which... It sounds like we have the negative on with Volkswagen, but there's some positivity there on the if you're in North America and you can buy yourself. If you do buy a diesel, we want to know about it. Maybe bring it down to Pennsylvania. Maybe we can drive it around. I'll take you to lunch.
Okay.
Next, JLR has built a factory, or they've had a factory for a while, but the Liverpool Echo did a tour of the Halewood factory, and the car is rolled out every 80 seconds. And this is the factory, it used to be a Ford factory years ago, and now they produce Evoque and Disco Sports. Apparently,
If I remember correctly, the Halewood is where they were making the X-Type, the rebadged Ford Mondeo.
Oh, okay.
I could be wrong, but I think that's where they were making that, and that's where they started the transition from Ford to Jag.
Yeah, it's not. They just mentioned in this article that it was a former Ford factory.
Ancient history in automotive world today. Yeah.
So apparently, so the car comes out about every 80 seconds, and it takes 48 hours to produce a car. So you know,
that's quite a few in progress.
Yes, it is, and I'm sure it's. I suspect they're not doing three shifts around the clock. I suspect it might be one or two shifts, but they didn't. That's not clear here. But they do employ a good number of people. 4,200 people are employed directly on site by JLR. So it's there's a plant they're producing, and that's probably if you get a Disco Sport, I suspect that's where they come from. But if you want to, and go ahead, check the show notes and get the link to the article, and you can. There's a video tour. That's the main point of this. You can take a look at a behind the scenes look at the factory. I think it's just 3 or 4 minutes, but.
And we'll get to the Defender later, but obviously that's a much better production rate than the Defender.
Well, you're
considering
not.
They only just hit 2 million.
Well, you're not bolting the bulkhead by hand and setting the panel gaps by hand,
and you weren't running one shift.
True.
Just don't forget that they only started ramping up to three shifts in the last year because just to meet the demand for the end of the line. But we should, we can hold that too.
The difference is Halewood probably employs the same number of people in three shifts that Solihull did in one.
Yes, they probably employ, and they also employ. Three times as many robots as they do people to
order
to make it. Whereas the Defender there was like three robots total, and that usually was just a conveyor to move the thing down.
Right.
It was all hand built. So. Moving to the United States, JLR has announced an inaugural startup for their tech incubator. Apparently, they have some sort of office or incubation, technological incubation facility in Portland, Oregon. And they're working with, the Silicon Valley types. I read the article. I'm still not exactly sure what's happening.
Is this just a new line of business for them? Are they trying to encourage automotive technology innovation or just general technology?
I think it's general technology because something – the article here says – this is from Forbes. This inaugural class includes the wearable business BabyBit, parking information provider Parkit, and Urban Systems, a company in the electric vehicle infrastructure space. So I think
it still sounds somewhat like it's tied to the automotive industry.
I think so. That would make sense. Why would you go out of your lane? They typically don't go out of their lanes either, at least that I've seen from Jag.
Yeah, that would be a serious diversification for them if they were.
Yeah.
And they already do quite a bit of, R&D for the technology side of Land Rover developments. I mean, we've seen all of the invisible bonnet and invisible trailer stuff. You can remote control your Range Rovers. So,
where is my phone? It must be upstairs. Yeah, I could remotely control my. Can I control my 109 and have it go?
I'm not sure you can control your 109 when you're behind the wheel.
Truth, Dave. Truth. You're absolutely right, Dave.
I can attest to that one.
I'm not sure anybody can control that thing at times.
You can, however, use your phone to locate the keys for the 109.
I can use that to locate the keys. Speaking of keys, a man was trapped in his Range Rover, and I'm using quotes, and you'll explain why in a moment, because the vehicle went into super lock mode. This happened in San Juan Capistrano in California. And I have to read this on purpose. It took Orange County firefighters about half an hour today to free a man from his 2001 Range Rover Discovery 2 that went into super lock mode when he was inside the vehicle. I just annoyed, of course, that they called it a Range Rover Discovery because all my friends tell me, oh, how's that Range Rover? And I have to explain to them.
And he's referring to the 109 at that point.
Yeah, exactly. The 109 is a Range Rover, yes.
About as non-Range Rover as they get.
So apparently the vehicle went into super lock mode. The firefighters came, and they thankfully another firefighter had the same kind of vehicle, explained what was going on, and he needed to have the key fob outside the vehicle. He climbed into the back. They opened up the hatch just enough to get the key fob out, and then they opened up the doors.
You can flex the window frame enough to pass the key out on those things. I don't know what the...
That happens naturally.
Yeah, well, that's how I get into them when they get locked.
Indeed.
Jack the window frame open, get in there with a long pointy stick and push the button.
Oh, you don't even need to do that. There's usually enough perforation in the rear seats, you know, in the rear seat wells on those that you just, you know, put your hand
up in there.
Well, that's
the D1s more than the D2s, but yeah.
There you go. So super lock mode, for those who aren't aware of it, the point of my understanding of super lock mode is you lock the vehicle and then you go into the super lock mode, which I forget how that happens, but it disables the inside door handles.
Right, so you can't open it from the inside.
So if someone were to smash the window and then they couldn't reach in and then open it up. How does it get into super lock mode? Don't you have to hold it? Do you have to hold the button down?
You can put it in super lock mode from the center.
You turn the key, don't you?
No.
Don't you have to put the key in the door and turn it?
If you lock it twice or three times.
Okay, is there a button? But that's not the button, though, right? If you, on your key fob, if you push that, does it go into super lock mode?
I think you can do that with the button also, pushing it
twice. Yeah, and you can do it from the center
console?
Yeah, the center console button, too.
Or you can probably achieve that function a couple of other ways if there's a malfunction in your lock system, which may or may not be the issue.
I'm sure that has to be what happened to the guy, because if you use the center console button when you're inside the vehicle, it will unlock it,
right,
whether it's in super lock mode or not. So either this guy had a malfunction or he was just an idiot. So,
well, perhaps he was working on it and had the dash partly removed and the button was on the bench outside the vehicle at the time.
Well, then he shouldn't have been driving it.
Well, this is the reason number one when vehicles come into my shop that the window goes down before I get out of it.
I will second that.
I learned that in college. We had some Buicks given to us, and they would, as we called it, going Christine. You go to operate the thing, you go to start it up, and immediately all the doors would lock, and then the vehicle would die, completely die, electrically shut down, and you're trapped in the vehicle.
I hope you had one of those window breakers.
We would just wave somebody down who was walking through the shop yard at the time, and they would open it from the outside. Yeah, it was still openable from the outside. Get that? But it's like it turned into the back seat of a cop car or something. But yeah, it's
a childproof lock, the child lock system. Moving on to the best news I've heard in a long time relating to Land Rovers, the Freelander has now considered a heritage vehicle.
Is that the Freeloader or the Puke Lander?
See, you were waiting. You were just waiting to do this to me, weren't
yes,
you?
Yes, I was.
And so, I'm just thinking that's the nicest thing that could be said about a Series 1 Freelander.
Hey, it's now classified as a heritage vehicle, so that means that it will continue stocking spare parts, 9,000 different components for the recently discontinued model, because it's no longer a contemporary vehicle. So
well, what is tragic about this is that
it's going to encourage people to keep their Freelanders.
Well. I was going to say, Harold, you had one in your driveway until recently, and a mishap
resulted
in its destruction.
Well, yeah. So apparently,
you could have resurrected it.
Apparently, Freelanders did not like chimneys falling upon them.
I don't know any cars that like chimneys falling on them.
It's easier
to recover from that problem in a series truck, for instance, than it would be in a Freelander.
True. So the Freelander will join the Range Rover Disco Series 1, Series 2, Series 3, and I guess Defender eventually, because I don't think Defender is on that list yet. But there you go. So, all the mighty Freelanders, please step up. You are now a heritage vehicle.
Yeah, I don't know how big Freelander is in the States, but when I was at Billings last year, you know, there's such a huge following for it, and it's still a Land Rover, and the poor Freelander guys get such a bad bloody rap for this, and I feel sorry for them because they buy Land Rovers and they're just so into it, and let's hope they're going to go and buy themselves a series and a Defender thereafter, but we've got to give the Freelander guys a bit of a break.
Well, I agree. I feel sorry for anybody who buys a Freelander thinking he's getting a Land Rover.
That's a shot at me. Don't worry. It's a shot at me.
Yeah.
And ultimately, it doesn't matter because with John, it wouldn't have mattered if it was a Freelander. Well, we'd still be harassing him.
John, that's true. That's true.
John provides so many opportunities for picking on him.
I do. Craig, my very first Land Rover was, in fact, a Freelander. They came to the United States, and I got one of the first ones that came here, and they that was my entry. And the main reason I got it, to be candid, was I didn't have to put premium fuel in it. And because I really like, yeah, I liked the discos.
Yeah, lovely reason.
Well, at the time, I didn't have the cash to just freely spend on fuel that was probably $3 or $4 a gallon, and a premium was even more.
And you hadn't really thought about doing the math on the life cycle cost, and when you get to 60,000 miles, you got to do a $3,000 timing belt change.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, those are things I didn't
versus
know about.
Going to 100,000 or the first time you blow a head gasket to do a timing chain for $100.
Yeah. Well, I didn't know Harold at the time. And anyways, so
I would have set you straight.
I know you would have, but that was my foray into it, and I liked it, and it was enjoyable, and
it worked for you.
And
I
it
gotta
was,
say.
And it was also the best selling vehicle in Europe, and it was Land Rovers that was making them money and keep them going. So,
And let's face it, compared to most of the other very small SUVs in the U.S. market, it was still probably the most capable.
Well, and I think what helped
there were very few.
I think what helped them in Europe also was it was available with a diesel.
Oh, yeah. And it was also utilitarian. It had that capability to have different styles and different models. People used it as a, almost like a transit van. They could use it for the family. They could get the smaller version if they wanted, if it was just them. So,
and I think it was at a different price point in Europe, too. So you could get it as a family station wagon, whereas here you really have to be into it to spend $40,000 on.
It was 30 when I got it. Mine was 30. Well, but still.
Still more than it should have been.
Yes. Well, but I think Land Rover's positioned themselves here as a premium vehicle, and it was not necessary. I don't think the Freelander was ever a premium vehicle.
Well, and it was conceived as an entry level, and it just you couldn't quite do an entry level on a premium brand here.
Right. It's difficult. Yeah. Which I think that's what the Disco Sport's trying to do is become that premium entry level vehicle. But there's also more competitors in the space, too.
Right.
And they've educated people here more than I think when they brought the Freelander in originally.
I think the Disco Sport is in a better position to do that now than the Freelander was 15 years ago.
Yeah, I don't think Land Rover as a brand could ever try and push anything in as an entry level anything. It's a premium brand, and the moment you try and manufacture an entry level anything and a premium brand, you're just asking for a lot of trouble and a lot of opening yourself up for a lot of. A lot of flack.
Right. Yeah.
Well, you have to cheapen the product to the point where you dilute the brand.
Exactly.
Well, which I think is what the Freelander was to me. That's why the Freelander seemed to be. It was like the quality materials I thought wasn't there, and there were some neat design things. But
I mean, they were capable for what they were, but you couldn't pound them the same way you could a real Land Rover. And, for instance, you can't do a frame swap on a Freelander once they get rusty. Mm-hmm. You throw them away.
Well, so Harold, how long would a Freelander have lasted with me?
10 minutes.
That long?
Not
off-road?
Not as long as it did with John, but, yeah. If you did try to treat one of your Toyotas the same way you treat your Land Rover, how long would that last?
Oh, yeah, never.
There you go.
Yeah.
I wouldn't do anything to any vehicle that I drive other than my Land Rover that I do to my Land Rover.
Well, you think about it, a Freelander, a first-gen Freelander is basically a British Toyota.
Yeah.
Well,
but there's still a lot of them on the road, and you won't find the same age vehicle, that many of the same age vehicle on the road as what you want Freelanders, because they still last as long or longer than many other vehicles of the same category.
And they have parts available for them, which is part of it, too.
It's aluminium. Beautiful.
Yeah. I think the undiscussed thing and unnoticed here in the United States is the Freelander 2, which they renamed to the LR2. There's still a lot of those on the road, and they were way more reliable than the original Freelander.
That's because
here.
They were mechanically a Volvo.
It doesn't matter. There's still a lot on the road. They're still out there, and that had kept them going. And they renamed it. But
I'll tell you what, I kind of liked.
Not noticed.
I kind of liked the Freelander too, LR2.
I like. I liked it less because it I guess having had the first one, and I really enjoyed it, and I liked it, and you know, kind of fell in love with it, I suppose, because I think it has a soul. Yeah, a little teaser again. But the two, I don't know. It started getting to that. It looked like all the other trucks again to me, the interior still wasn't up to that. What I thought a Land Rover Premium was supposed to be, but I mean, it's not bad. I would recommend that to someone who's looking to get into a Land Rover and they're not sure what they want, and it's a little cheaper. I think you pick up a good used LR2 here.
It still could be a decent car.
And yeah. A decent car, and it's a good for like our zone of, you know, how much snow we get. That would probably be like almost a perfect vehicle, because you know, you need it occasionally. You don't, and you need the all wheel. You don't need four wheel all the time. Yeah. And it also boils down to, let's think about any four-wheel drive. How often do you use it for its purpose intended? How many people buy a Range Rover and really take it off-road?
I was going to say,
you know, it's...
Do you want me to answer that? Or
I think it's more rhetorical, and we all know the answer. You know, and Land Rover knows that too, which you know takes us into discussing you know, the end of the Defender line. You know, Land Rover knows this. They know how people use their vehicles and what they don't do with their vehicles.
The difference is, I mean, because... I mean, you could say the same thing about Discoveries as well, but what it comes down to is that these vehicles don't get used a lot for their intended purpose until they become old. Well, once you get a Discovery or a Range Rover that's 10, 12 years old, all bets are off, and you're starting to see
them
on the
trail. Well, then people like me buy them.
Yeah, because they can afford to.
Right.
And they become a cheap sort of... throwaway, you know, from a risk management standpoint, you can afford to
it's take second
that
or third car
with them,
and you can take the risks. Yeah.
Well, see, that was my thinking originally, but let's face it, I'm still driving my first Disco. Of course, I own like three other ones, but
well, you have to keep parts on your first.
I wonder how many original pieces are on that first one.
The body's all original, and it looks like it.
That's true. So why don't we move into the big discussion? We say we're not going to have to talk a lot about it, but I wonder. Friday, January 29th is 2016. We're in 2016. I haven't written a check yet. We'll go down in history as a sad day in Land Rover world when the Defender production came to an end. And
we could talk for 8 hours straight on that.
And
no problem.
And we have.
Yeah.
You know, I guess really the point here is to say that production ended. I'll have some links to a couple of the stories that were out there if you're interested. If you aren't already aware, or you want to read a little more about it, I found a couple of interesting stories that I liked. And there was a lot of discussion, and it made the big news even here in the U.S. Made general news.
Now, did I read correctly that the last Defender off the line is going to the British Motor Museum?
That is my understanding. The final one that came off had it looked exactly like the first one, the UE,
right.
What they call UE.
And the plate was, yeah.
And the plate
was
similar.
It was a plate.
It's similar. It's like H199.
Huey, well, instead of Huey 166, it's H166 Huey.
Yeah.
I think that's it. Yeah, it's a similar resemblance.
But it's as close as they could possibly get with modern number plate standards.
Correct. And I believe this is going to the Motor Museum.
Which would be nice. It gives them a bookend because they have Huey.
Exactly, right. But I believe it's going to be on a James May mentioned about they're going to be doing a big Land Rover thing on he has a show in the UK on Sunday nights. I think it's tonight, or maybe it's tomorrow night. Cars for the People, which we don't get here in the U.S., and I guess he's going to do a big Land Rover thing. I think I think both UEs, if we call this the last one UE also, went to him for his show. I went to the BBC because I saw a picture for that. Are you familiar with that, Craig? Have you seen that show? Do you know what I'm talking about?
No, I haven't. It's interesting that you mention it because it's obviously there are a few of those sort of personalities that I want to hunt down for the book, but I'm not familiar with the show.
I follow him on Twitter, James May, that is, and I follow him on Twitter, and he talks about this Cars for the People show, and apparently it's on BBC Two, I think Monday nights.
They've put a couple episodes of something like that on BBC America in the past.
I think they have, but it's sporadic. You know,
it's a special thing at that point. It's not a recurring show.
Right. Yeah. So to answer your question, Harold, I believe it is going to the Motor Museum. It would make complete sense. That's what happened. You know, the last one looked a lot like the first one.
I like that notion, too.
I think it's great.
Yeah,
it's great. So,
just coming back to the whole conversation about the end of Defender, it's my understanding that this isn't the end of Defender. It's just the end of Defender production at Solihull. You know, obviously they're relaunching Defender in 2 years or whenever they actually get their act together on this.
70th anniversary.
So it's not the end of Defender. It's just the end of this era of Defender, is it not?
The end Correct. Of the Defender as we know it.
Yeah.
Well, let's...
But the end of Defender as we knew it, well, the end of series as we knew it, you know, that caused its own set of problems. So there's always... people are always averse to change. And obviously this is a big change primarily because it's changing the manufacturing facility as well, which was obviously... part of the heritage. I mean, every single Land Rover fanatic on the planet knows or has heard of Solihull. So the fact that these things aren't being made at Solihull in the mall anymore is quite sad. But it's not the end.
Well, did you guys hear, and I don't know whether where I heard this from was credible or not, but they're taking Solihull, the factory, and they're going to start refurbishing series and Defenders.
Yes, that is true.
I did hear that.
But I think that's going to be – I suspect that's going to be a limited operation.
Oh, I'm sure it will be.
And there's
it's still
– there's also to kind of what – alluding to what Craig had mentioned, there is – you know, there's supposed to be – Land Rover, every time I saw their tweets and I saw the stories, it was always this is the last production of the Defender in Solihull. And you could, you know, yeah, you can read between the lines. What exactly does that mean? There is – and then I've read other things certainly that indicate that maybe the Defender name will continue. The way that we know the truck has ended, the way it's been produced has ended, which I will just generically say it was a manual production. It was hand built, and the new one's going to be not hand built. It can't be to meet the numbers that they want to meet, because right now they were producing, not last year, take the last year out, I think they were producing somewhere along the lines of 10 or 15,000 vehicles a year, and that was it. And they were running one shift, all hand built, and that was, and they were building all different kind of model types. The new one, Jerry McGovern has said, they need to produce, I think it's in the hundreds of thousands is what they want to get to. And
well, that will result in a design that can be produced on basically any modern assembly line. They can build them anywhere. And that doesn't preclude them from retooling Solihull and making them there as well.
Correct. But
at some point in the future.
I think I just get some feeling, and just reading between many lines, I think Solihull is going to become kind of a heritage location,
which I think would be cool.
I think it would be kind of cool. Mm-hmm. And there's thought is the current line going to be dismantled and moved? Is the current line going to be turned into some sort of restoration and then maybe a heritage thing? The Slovakia, they're going to build a plant in Slovakia. Is that going to be the new location? They have not said exactly. It could be Slovakia. It could be there's a good article that I'm referencing on. I should mention it now. Land Rover Owner International, Mike Goldbun, I think is their editor. Really nice article. I'll certainly have a link to it in the show notes. Is this the end? What's next for Defender? And there's a plant near. I'm trying to read and talk at the same time. There's a plant in the UK that it might be used for that. Could they retool it? Things are coming out. The new model is supposed to be announced, I think, next year, and then they're looking at a 2017 release, which would be the 70th – no, sorry, 18. Maybe a model year 18, that would be the 70th anniversary of Land Rover, and I think that's what they're targeting, and that would be the new one. I did find numbers, so I should read them. Of the 400,000 or so vehicles Land Rover builds every year, only 15,000 to 20,000 are Defenders. So that's from that article. Land Rover says the next Defender needs to be capable of 60,000 to 100,000 sales per year to wash its face. I'm not sure what that means. That's probably a British thing. So did that answer? I think that was answer some of your questions, Craig, of the things we've heard.
Yeah, and that actually echoes an article that I read in Land Rover Owner probably over a year ago, which was saying that they're only selling 10,000 odd Defenders, and it's not financially feasible to keep these vehicles going, which is understandable. And I think the world just needs to sort of put their big boy pants on and get over it. And
you sound like Jerry McGovern. He's the chief designer. He basically said the same things.
Well,
he's like,
change happens, and that's right. The thing.
Right.
And it happens in every single model across all brands, and everyone has a fit when a new, dynamically new shape comes out.
Yep.
I do think it is. It's great that they've, you know, that Land Rover has put so much attention into, you know, the ending of the production, just showing off exactly how much the heritage all ties together and making, you know, a big event out of it.
Yeah, I don't think they could have done the send off any better.
Yeah, and but you've got to give kudos to I think to the marketing team for that, because you know, Land Rover is a heritage brand, and if they hadn't sort of noticed that or taken note of it and used it in their send off to build a platform for the next vehicle, that would have been silly.
I know you say that, but I tend to think, and this is my personal opinion, I don't think Jerry McGovern, who's the designer, I don't think he cares about heritage. I think they just did it because he had to. And he was in some of the pictures and I saw him there, but his comments over the years, and this is even referenced in that LR article, is, you know, the current Defender has never sold on its design. What's he thinking?
Yeah, well, and has changed. That's why I call him Clueless Jerry.
And has changed very little over the years. What we are working on is something that will be more desirable to look at.
More desirable for him to look at.
He's
maybe.
Completely. I agree. He's completely clueless, I don't think he gets it. I don't think Jerry thinks it's a heritage company. They're looking to sell units, and they're, you know, and I think it was up to him. This is again my opinion. I think it was up to him. They would have shut the line down 2 years ago, and he would have said, "You're getting a new Defender. Suck it up. It's going to look like the DC-100, and yeah, that's life."
Well, I think he basically, you know, he's arrogant enough that he doesn't like anything he didn't design.
It's very possible. Yeah, that's very possible.
Not to bash his designs necessarily. I think he's done some interesting products in the past, but you know, he's not the be all and end all.
No. Well, and design should service the theme of, I think, of the vehicle and the theme of the mark. And I don't know. We'll see if it happens. Now, reading on in this article, maybe to bring that up, if I can find it while I'm talking. And there's not a lot of people talking. They're really good at the security and the secrecy on what's coming up. But the things that LRO has heard is that the new model's coming. It's pretty much, I'm going to put a number on it, like 80% done, and people are going to like it, they say.
It's not
the DC-100 too, I should say.
Well, and that's fine. And I think ultimately it's going to be a nice vehicle. And, you know, just my observation is, you don't necessarily have to call it a Defender. What's wrong with retiring that name like they do with baseball players? Retire the jersey, retire the number.
Well, you know, if you look at the relative success that Beetle had when they relaunched their Beetle, you know, I wouldn't say it's been a massive success, but it's been relative success. And there are many other brands out there that are now starting to rejuvenate the old models, and I don't think this is not quite a rejuvenation, but why kill a model that's actually iconic and going well?
Well,
you know, you'd have to rebrand and remarket an entirely new vehicle. Oh, it's like the Defender, but it's now this. I don't think
they did a good job when they introduced the Defender name. That was something straight out of the blue.
Agreed. How many freaking series models? Series 23. You know, you've got to get over that at some stage. You know what
right,
I mean?
Right. And the Defender did a good job with that. And the point I'm trying to make is, if you are a company driven by heritage and a heritage company, why would you want to take this iconic heritage name and apply it to something that really shares none of that heritage with what came before it?
But do we know that it shares none of the heritage?
Well,
I think it's going to be along the lines. I think the only things that they're really needing to do is address shape, safety. I don't believe the emissions. There's a lot of talk about emissions. I think that's a lot of crap.
I agree.
You can just change a motor and sort out the exhaust and your emissions sorted.
Right, emissions is a non-issue.
I think the
it's so often quoted. Emissions. It's not. It's safety.
I think it's a cover story. One of the big
production costs too.
I think there's production costs, and they're leaving money on the table in the United States because it is not available here. and they are yeah. and they're and
well, that, and that's purely emissions.
No, that's
no,
purely
it's safety.
Safety.
It's safety because it's the well, airbag. Yeah. It's the
and
airbag.
You can make that's emissions true. Pass. It's the yeah. safety.
It's
stuff.
A safety, but they're leaving money on the table, and it's not all of it. But I think this is a good part of it. I think the safety and emission issues in Europe was used as a cover. As cover. No, it's not all of it, but it's a little bit of cover. And they wanted to. They're leaving money on the table. They're doing very well as we talked at the beginning of the show. They're selling very well in the United States. It's I think their number one market. China's I think number two and up and coming. And that name has great cachet here, as we know, because you know, models here sell for 3, 4, 5, 10,000 times what they sold for when they were new, right. even though they have 100,000 miles on them, and they're falling apart.
There's money in rusty old trucks.
There's money in rusty old trucks, and Land Rover's not getting that money, and rightfully so. They should come for it. Why not? We would love the name, you know, and more trucks here would be good for us.
If the truck was up to the name, that's the problem.
And we will find out.
No,
it yeah. really just comes down to what they give us.
Yes, which goes to in the article that from LRO, this is probably a good opportunity for this. This is his checklist for what the next Defender must have and mustn't have. And I'll just read through these quickly, and then we can talk about it. It must have best off-road articulation, approach and departure angles, range of body styles to suit all user requirements, slim as a current model, a range of torquey engines, 3.5-ton, British number, towing capacity, best-in-class on-road performance and handling, and ability to personalize the current model, like the current model. Mustn't have rakish looks leading to poor visibility, especially when driving off-road. Easily dented, shouldn't have easily dented body panels that don't wear damage well. Shouldn't have needless complexity that compromises reliability and durability in the field, and mustn't have a 25,000 pound plus VAT minimum price tag, which would be 40 grand here. So those are his checklists of things that it shouldn't and should have.
I will add to that a little bit. In his comment about a range of body styles, I think part of what makes a Defender is not so much just the range of body styles, but the fact that you can change those body styles on a whim. You can put a hard top on it for the winter. You can unbolt that hard top and put a soft top on it for the summer. You can change from a pickup to a station wagon with a little bit of work.
Are you going to be able to get that, though, in a modern vehicle with the, you know, if they use the way they have the frames and the bodies integrated and,
well,
you know,
I think having
rigidity?
Remain body on frame versus being unibody, I think, is key also to the utilitarian high-strength nature of the Defender, and I think that needs to stay as well. But, you know, it is possible to make that change. I think there is some compromise relative to safety, but it's still doable.
Yeah, in fact, Jeep does that currently with their line of their most, I can't remember the JK?
Yeah, the JK Unlimited.
So you can get that soft top or hard top, and the hard top is removable. And in fact, while it's not direct from Jeep, you can get pickup truck conversion kits for them.
Yes.
So it's doable.
Well,
yeah, I think it really. It's a function of whether or not Land Rover themselves want to acknowledge this heritage and all these things that are important to us Defender Land Rover people versus what's important to them, which is ultimately rands and cents dollars. And I've seen that quite often, having dealt with various Land Rover. At head office level, and sadly, it's to them. It's about selling widgets and not selling Land Rovers. And whether or not that filters down into the design and ultimately the end product is it's another thing to be just seen. But it's a very disheartening thing to recognize that when you go into various and meet various head office people.
So you're saying that you've met with the upper level JLR folks, and that's what you're thinking?
I've met with upper level JLR folk in South Africa. So the distribution side of things, and they speak heritage when it's important to speak heritage. And when they need to sell widgets based on heritage, but they are widget sellers. they could be selling freaking Toyotas or whatever it is. They right. just don't care. All they need to do is sell numbers. And I've just noticed that probably over the last 4 years, I've started to notice that more and more they've had staff turnover, and that staff turnover has generated widget sellers and not Land Rover sellers. It's quite sad. It's actually incredibly frustrating to deal with it as a person who's like incredibly passionate about the brand. To walk in there and you got all this passion, and they are like, "Yeah, well, you know, let's talk money. Let's talk widgets."
Well, that happens here too, because here you drive even an old Disco into your local dealership, and they'd rather you not.
Yeah,
100%. We showed up at a dealer event in year 110, and they didn't know what it was.
Oh, I know.
They didn't know what it was, literally.
I know. They didn't want to know what it was. Yeah.
I have to tell you a little story. So I get to this this meeting for my event, and I have Land Rover there, what was she? She was the sponsorship manageress or something to that effect. I don't remember her name. And we're sitting around and we're discussing their stand at my event, and she was saying, "Yeah, no, what we want to do is we want to have the like father like son image, where you had the it was the Range Rover Sport or the new Range Rover and the classic, like the adverts." And she was saying, "Oh, I'm really battling to get the a classic Land Rover," and I said, "Well, why don't you just get a Defender and a Series?" And she said, "A series of what?" And I said, "A series? A series?" She says, "I heard you the first time. A series of what?" I was like, "Okay. Now I know what I'm dealing with, yeah?"
Yep, answered everything right there. Yep.
Yeah, and it was just – I was sitting with the Land Rover Owners Club guy, and he looked at me like, okay, what are we dealing with here?
Right, right. Well
– open palm, insert face.
Yeah. Although, you know, things we've heard from some of our other guests over the years is that the folks at Sully Hall, those upper level guys, at least the ones, this was a couple of years ago and even to now, some of them at least still understand heritage and they understand the line. You know, we've had Graham Aldous on who did the LR65 video, and he knows Roger Cranthorne, and although Roger just retired from Land Rover, his discussion was those guys still understand heritage. And even Jeff Aronson, who is the editor of Rovers magazine here in the U.S., you know, he says that they understand heritage and understand that. So there's at least maybe the thought is that at the super high levels there might still be some of that left, but maybe it doesn't translate down to the into the sales side. But
well, I think once those people retire, you're going to have a hard time.
And as those people retire, we got more and more problems. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's why it's so partially so impressive that the marketing department has done so well there. The marketing department has been able to hold on to that, whereas all the other departments have sort of let that get lost.
I think that's it, and I think, like we were saying earlier on, it's the wisdom within the marketing department that has identified it and probably force it back. You know, saying, "Guys, we can't sell these things if you're not addressing heritage, because your entire brand is built on heritage."
No, it's their greatest asset, without a doubt.
Yeah.
Although I might say, their sales are not going down with what they're not doing. So we don't think they're focusing enough on heritage, but sales are not going down. They're doing well, at least here in the U.S. So that is not going to affect.
The question is, would they have gone up as much if they hadn't been focusing on heritage?
Well, they don't have the Defender here in the U.S. They're leaving. That goes to my point. They're leaving money on the table. Doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. I'm sure there are some people who worry about what's the Defender going to be like. Does it meet the current Defender? But you know, at the end of the day, they're leaving money on the table, and it's like we're going to put something out. You know, I suspect that this is going back to the Freelander. I suspect that at one point the Freelander was thought maybe to be some sort of a replacement, because the Defender was considered kind of an entry level vehicle into Land Rover. They didn't have an entry level vehicle in the U.S. for Land Rover that they wanted, and I thought, you know, the Freelander seemed to be that way. In an entry-level vehicle, something cheaper that wasn't much, gets you into the brand. And then
affordable way to get into Land Rovers.
And then get you into, you know, and then you can buy a Disco.
Get you addicted, and then you start buying real ones.
And then you start buying, then you buy your, you know, $80,000 Range Rover. So.
Right.
All right. Well, this is the time of the podcast. I'm going to crack a beer, and we're going to raise our glasses. Everybody, get your
crack a beer using your 110 beer opener.
Here we go from Rovers North. I bought that.
Why didn't you tell me this?
It's
I would have had a beer in bed.
That's okay. John's the only one who has a beer anyway.
Would you like a beer? This was the apocryphal beer, you know, one for everybody. So, raise your glass to the defender. There we go. All right.
I'll have a piece of chocolate
And now that you said that, your bottle has proceeded to leak upon your counter.
The king is dead. Long live the king. And now, the M word.
This month, for the M word, we will just observe a moment of silence for the end of the defender.
Welcome back to the 34th edition of the Center Steer Podcast. It is January 2016. Our guest this month is Craig Dutton. Craig is the photographer. You may know him from My Land Rover Has a Soul. MyLandRoverHasASoul.com is the website. Welcome, Craig.
Hey, how's it going?
Oh, fantastic. Thanks for joining us on the show today and providing your insight. So tell us about My Land Rover Has a Soul. It's a book. Is that right? Or it will
it is
be
a book.
Book.
It starts it off as a book, and it exploded into so much more than that. But let me tell you how it all started. I was sitting on the sides of the Limpopo River in 2012-ish, 2011, taking photographs of a cycling event, and this Land Rover 130 Defender was crossing the river, crossing the Limpopo, which is about 100-meter wide river. And it was just such a beautiful image, and I took a photograph of this, and I thought, man, I need to do 100 of these, you know, and just tell these stories. And Land Rovers are just so photogenic.
This was crossing the river in a no bridge required sort of way.
Absolutely, there was zero bridge. It is funny enough. It's a border crossing, but you need a 4x4 to cross over from one country to the other. Because
okay, that's cool. No that's bridge. Cool.
Nothing wrong with that.
That is cool. Was there water over the bonnet? Water over the bonnet.
Oh yeah,
oh.
Yeah. No, it's a proper wade. You need to. You kind of need if you've never waded before.
I have
a 100-meter wide wade across a river that has crocodiles in it is quite something.
And with one country on one side and another country on the other,
exactly
the only way to cross.
I suspect there are men with guns on both sides.
Nah,
and that's. Okay.
But you know what? They probably were, but it's not that not that crazy.
You're right.
The only reason why they have guns is because it is quite a wildlife infested area, especially on the Botswana side. So you could run into any form of wildlife, lion, elephant, something like that.
So you were taking photographs, and you thought you should make a book.
Exactly. Like I say, it was just such a photogenic moment, and
How long ago was that?
It was I think 2011 or 2012.
Okay. So so you're on year four of or year five now, trying to get the book going, but something's happened in between, didn't it?
Oof, man. Yeah, I.
We call that life getting in the way.
Exactly. I decided that. Before I go, I wanted to self-publish the book. That was the first requirement. And before I did that, I thought I'd create a bit of awareness about the project. And I created a Facebook page called My Land Rover Has a Soul. And from there on, I decided that we should get to have a little barbecue, you know, just a little weekend, a couple of Land Rovers, have a barbecue, and everything would be a lot of fun. And I thought, well, hey, hang on. If we're going to have a barbecue, let's get an exhibitor or two and try and, you know, get the guys have something to look at. And if you're going to do that, well, then we may as well camp. And if you're going to do that, well, hey, let's get something else to do. And I found this Guinness World Record for the most Land Rovers in convoy. And I thought, well, that would be fun to break. So I organized a massive convoy of 1,007 vehicles, which completely obliterated the official record, which was 348 vehicles. But we didn't get the record because we had our gaps were too big in the convoy, and that Guinness World Record said that we needed a 2.5 or 3.5 vehicle gap between the vehicles, and sometimes there were 5. I mean, you try and have 1,000 vehicles in a 27-kilometer long convoy driving without concertina. It was like herding cats. It's impossible.
Could chain them together.
Yeah.
Probably had to keep something going.
I had the post that weekend, I had every convoy expert in the country telling me how I should run a convoy of 1,000 vehicles.
Of course.
I'm sure.
And there is no way. The only way to do it is everybody's got to be wide awake and drive decently. And we had one accident on the one rear-ending accident on the route. One series broke down. One series never made it out of the car park.
Only one?
Yeah, that's a good percentage, really.
Yeah.
It's 1,000 vehicles. One never made it out.
That's fantastic.
But you hit on why this could never be done in our country. You said that everybody's got to be awake and everybody's got to be a good driver. You can't find that many people in this country who know how to drive
anything, let alone a Land Rover.
Yeah.
What's the requirement for this? So it's a convoy, so you have to be all vehicles moving. Is there a minimum number of – is it like a mile or
– Yeah, it was the minimum distance that we needed to travel was 2.5 kilometers. So I don't know how much that is in miles. Probably about 1.5 miles.
About a mile and a half. Yeah.
Yeah.
It needed to the each vehicle needed to pass over that distance. We needed to capture details for every single person: driver's license number, driver's video footage, photographic footage. I had helicopter in the air getting video footage. What else was there? And then, of course, just that damn following distance, which let us down. I actually went across to London to plead the case, and there was sorry, no can do. We can give you dispensation for your next attempt, but we won't allow you to do it, in hindsight.
Are you going to try it again?
I did try it again. I tried. The following year, I did a big logo.
Remember that
on a field. Mm-hmm. That was great. We had 525 vehicles in the logo, so effectively we still beat the British record for the most vehicles parked in the area.
Right.
We didn't get the required vehicles for the logo, so we didn't break that record. Then I tried it the next year again to try and break the record, and the numbers have just dwindled since. It was one of those one shot wonder things, and we've got to leave it for 10 years and bring it back just to try to do it every year, as the British have found it themselves. Their record, their numbers just keep on going down. But having said that, the event itself, Landy Festival, has grown from strength to strength. We've really had some good years. We've had four solid years of growth. It's the biggest Land Rover event of its kind in the Southern Hemisphere, and it's fantastic, man. It's such a great atmosphere.
So do you help organize Landy Festival? Or are you part of it? Or you are Landy Festival?
I organize it. Me and this chick here, we organize Landy Festival.
Hey!
the one that's lying in bed next to me.
She's been quiet this whole time.
Plus 9 at night.
Been quiet this whole time, pretending not to be there.
Yeah, she's just watching a TV program or something on her iPod.
Trying not to let us disturb her, I guess.
So my wife and I organized the event in its entirety. It's been a bit of a baptism of fire, but my photographic experience is with events. I shoot events. So I've been around events for 14 years. So it's not too foreign in terms of, seeing how they are run and being involved in the running of them to actually organizing my own event. But it is a lot of work and it's a lot of stress. There's a lot of financial stress that goes into that, and sponsorship hasn't been easy to come by. But we have an enormous support from the South African or Southern African Land Rover owners. And so it's been exactly what they needed and what they wanted. And it's been a great path, which kind of slowed down the work on my book a bit. But in hindsight, it wasn't a bad thing to slow down the work on the book, because I've changed the model of how I wanted to do the book. Initially, the book was all about just great pictures of Land Rovers. And since my visit to Billing last year and my subsequent discussion with Patrick Kravachen from Land Rover Monthly magazine, I've now decided that it needs to be more than just a book of Land Rover photographs, but it's got to tell the stories that kind of associate or bring together Land Rovers and the owners. And every Land Rover Land Rover owner has a great story to tell.
Absolutely. I think that's a great idea.
So it's been so awesome. Just listening and having those interviews with these people has been phenomenal.
That's really what makes Land Rover what it is.
Yeah.
So the Landy Festival takes place in South Africa. Is it always in the same place? And when is 16 going to occur?
So we've had Landy Festival at two different venues over the 4 years that we've been running it. The current venue is a place called Soet Doring Vakansieplaas, which is Afrikaans, and that is Sweet Thorn Vacation Farm, basically.
Nice.
We also moved the timing of our event. It used to be the first half of the year, and now we moved to the second half of the year just to give everyone a bit of financial relief from the festive season. That seemed to work out quite nicely for us. So August is the period that we run Landy Festival, and we haven't set a date for it this year, but it's August, early September, around about there.
Which is winter in the Southern Hemisphere. I assume it's not that cold, though.
No, it isn't. Certainly not. Look, it can drop down to one, between 1 and minus 1, minus 2 in that area. But
that's Celsius.
That's
still freezing.
Yeah, it is. But it's like bees to a honeypot for Land Rover owners, because then they just pull out their fires and
that's
sit
right.
around drinking mm-hmm. and telling stories around fires. You know, it's
same thing here. Yep.
Mm. Yeah, it's really it's fantastic. And that's, you know, I take a walk around the campsite, which has 1,000 people in the campsite, and there are just these clusters of people having drinks, telling stories around fires, and it really is. It's a goosebump moment every single year. It's phenomenal.
That's every Land
until they start getting a little bit hammered around about 2 o'clock in the morning, then it's not that phenomenal. Then it's just
could you imagine a 1,000 truck event on this continent?
No,
I mean, we've been to some big ones, but you know, we're talking 200 trucks,
2-3 at the most.
Yeah,
yeah. It's you wouldn't.
I can't say that I'd want to be at 1,000 trucks.
That would be. It depends on where.
Here.
Yeah. But
I don't know that I'd want 1,000 American idiots all lined up in the same place.
We're not all idiots.
No, but
if you have 1,000 of us together,
there's going to be a couple idiots.
Yeah, the chances are good you're going to encounter more than you want to.
I have to defend the podcast a bit. We have seen and talked about your events in the past.
Mm-hmm.
I remember we talked about the convoy. So I do remember the convoy,
yeah.
And we talked about the logo and everything. So we just didn't talk to you, and I'm glad we're finally getting to talk to you.
Our friends of the podcast, Graham and Louisa, have been to
your
event.
Yeah, I met them. They came to our first event. They had a GoPro that they were raffling off to raise money for their A2A trip.
Right.
Fantastic people. And we've kept in touch. Graham sent me a book, which I received at my last Landy Festival. It was just some guy walked up to me and said, "Are you Craig Dutton?" And I said, "Yeah." He says, "I've got a present from you, from Graham in America." And gave me the book, which is actually sitting next to my bed here. And
it's a good book.
Nice to see that the Land Rover Underground Railroad is worldwide.
Absolutely.
Have you heard about the Underground Railroad?
No, I haven't, but I can appreciate it. It works perfectly.
It's it it's a thing we talk here in America, but if you know you get a part from somebody and they'll, you know, different people go to different events, and so that will get handed off. And in fact, I got some sand ladders from a gentleman over on the other side of the Pennsylvania, and Dave picked them up for me in an event, and I got them. And we call that the Underground Railroad. So, you know, basically free shipping.
Works perfectly. I can appreciate that. But just to one thing I wanted to ask you guys was, you know, you're saying you're not sure if you'd win 1,000 people, 1,000 American Land Rover owners at an event. And my question to you is, in South Africa, we have distinctly different people that drive different brands.
Types of owners?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, we have that here.
The Land Rover crowd is absolutely fantastic. I mean, I say 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, I've had it. I think I've had it at every event where I've had problems with someone doing something stupid, but it's the exception and not the norm. Yet, not to name drop any other brand, but other brands have contacted me asking me to do an event because it's been a successful model. But there's no way I could do it. Because that type of person that brand attracts, I would be awake the whole night putting out fires. Is that the same sort of thing with you guys?
I don't know. It could be, but
if we were talking about Jeeps, absolutely, it'd be a train wreck.
Yeah.
Well, I think it's just basically pure numbers. I think because if you get a mark, it doesn't matter which one it is, and there's a lot of people in it, your chances, I think, of having some knuckleheads increases.
I think getting it. Enough wide open space for that many people would be difficult, yeah. too. A lot of the places we have events here are much more confined.
Well, here in the eastern half of the country.
Yeah, definitely.
Well, and that goes to my point about the number of Land Rover owners here is extremely limited, and so we're a little more friendly. We know each other, and because if you piss somebody off, someone's going to know about it. Even, that's
Everybody knows.
Everybody. It's and if they don't, they will.
Well, part of the problem with Land Rover here in the States is that, let's face it, those of us that actually get out and use our vehicles the way they are meant to are in an extreme minority.
Oh, we're in a minority of a minority. Yeah. Clearly. Absolutely. So. Yes. So to your point, I mean, I think if you got you got 1,000 Jeep owners together here in the U.S., I think your chances of
Having 100 idiots.
Some knuckleheads is going to be there. But if you got 1,000 Land Rover people together, you're still going to have probably the same number of knuckleheads.
Right.
That's just my opinion. Others may disagree. But of course, if you go to Europe, I think the same thing might happen. You know, you're going to get a bunch of Land Rover people together because it's easier. There's a bunch of them, and you're going to have X number of knuckleheads too. I don't know. Maybe not.
Yeah, I found that from the South African Landy Festival perspective, it really it definitely attracted a more calmer bunch of people. They just enjoyed. They just absorb that whole thing, walking around, looking at everyone's vehicles. It's been a great reunion type of thing, and people meeting each other 1 year and coming back next year. And if I could give one word of advice to anybody who would like to organize an event, and I've stuck to my guns on this, is don't organize your event to try and don't find a good venue in the middle of nowhere because people aren't going to come. You need to find a good venue close to a big center. The number of people that you have in your catchment is what's more important. And
And I think that would be the problem here too, definitely, because America is such a big, big country. And
it plays out.
Yeah.
And there really aren't that many Land Rovers as a percentage of the population. So getting enough people to show up over the distance is the limiting factor in the size of our events.
And that plays out here because you look at Virginia, you get big. There's a big percentage of Land Rover folks in Virginia, and you get a good turnout for their events. But then the main Winter Romp, for example, which is next weekend, you're going to get a handful of people.
Well, we'll get. But last time I was there, it was 104 trucks.
Okay, I'm wrong because that's really good for middle nowhere Maine.
For what that is, that's an extremely good
turnout. When I'm driving like 800 miles.
For how long it takes to get there, yeah.
Well, it takes a special kind of diehard to do that.
All right, Craig, we might be wrong. First for the podcast, we may be wrong.
Well, but I mean, there won't be many people that come as far as I do.
Yeah, but 100 trucks for Maine is, I think, a lot. when you get 200 for a Virginia event.
I think when you look at the number of Land Rovers in the northeastern United States, and I'm talking Massachusetts, Vermont, Connecticut, Maine,
and Quebec.
Yeah, and they get people out of Quebec.
Mm-hmm.
So,
I think that's really good.
When you look at that number, I don't think it is surprising. It's not as surprising as some of the stuff you see in Virginia, honestly.
As I said, I think we're now wrong.
And there really are no other events in February.
Right.
That's true.
That is true.
You should fly over. Change your plans, Craig. You should be going to the Winter Romp in Maine.
When is it?
Next weekend.
February.
No, it's the
it's
the 12th through the 14th.
It'll
happen, but it won't happen this year. I'm trying to move my family to Scotland next week, and that's in itself is a big move.
Indeed, yeah.
Get a stopover in Maine.
Yeah.
It's near New Scotland, Nova Scotia. That's New Scotland.
Well, when we
there you go. We goofed on our tickets.
That's it. Yes.
the whole thing with the Winter Romp, of course, is people then look at you and go, "You went where in February?
Yeah.
Why would you do that?
Yeah. I'd love to go. If I had the time.
That's the same looks I got in Minnesota when I went camping the end of January.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So Landy Festival will take place in August of this year, and Landy Festival has spurred came out of your book. And so tell us more about the book, because you have a website for it. You also are on Facebook.
Yep.
And what's the book going to be about? When's it coming out? How much? It's another question.
Right. A lot of questions that I have to think of fast.
We got to push product here. We were helping the Bells. We can help you.
Fantastic. So the book is about the book is called My Land Rover Has a Soul. Let me just tell you that the name came from the ex-marketing director of Land Rover South Africa, an absolute Land Rover fan. And I was sitting talking to him about the book concept over lunch one day, and we were just talking about just why it would be such a great book. And he said, "Craig, because Land Rovers have a soul." Like, boom. There it is. Thank you very much.
It's a great name.
I agree. It is really good.
It's fantastic. And so the book now is really about great pictures of Land Rovers and the stories that are attached to the Land Rover owners and those Land Rovers. And it is an absolute joy meeting every single Land Rover owner that I meet. And I go through the same set of questions. I record the interview and I ask questions about when did you get your first Land Rover? How long have you had your Land Rover? Some people, this is their first Land Rover and they've only had it for 2 years, but they're absolutely hooked. Other people have been driving Land Rovers for 40 years.
It only takes one to get addicted.
Absolutely. And the stories that come out of it are just phenomenal. And I've got to share at least two with you.
Please.
So I interviewed this.
To open up a new beer. If you're drinking along, it's time for a new beer.
Yeah, it is. I interviewed this young chap in Inverness. Took a photograph of his lovely old Series 2, which is on my site, on my Land Rover Has a Soul on the homepage. You'll see a picture of this youngster in the green Series 2, lots of trees and forest around. Series 3, sorry. Anyway, and I said to him, "No, you must have a memorable story about your Land Rover. That's it. You must have a memorable story about your Land Rover. Tell me what you got." He says, "Well, one day it was winter in Inverness. It is just freezing. I'd been to KFC to buy dinner, and I was on my way home, and my clutch packed up." He said he stops on the side of the road, opened his bonnet. No one wanted to stop in and assist, and he was pretty much stranded in Inverness in winter with his clutch slave cylinder gone.
Ugh.
He'd pushed out liquid, something like that. I don't really know what the problem was. He said, and then I remember that I had a bottle of Ribena. I don't know if you guys know what Ribena is.
I know what Ribena is.
Grape juice or
it's black
juice,
currant.
Whatever it is.
Black currant juice.
Blackcurrant juice, that's it.
I have a bottle upstairs.
He poured his Ribena into his clutch slave cylinder or his and literally got home on Rabina.
That is a great story, actually.
Right. Yeah. It's just fantastic. I just love it. And, you know, it's these sort of stories.
Did it stay fixed after that?
No, I don't think so. But and he's a young guy. He's about 28 or something like that. And
genius.
You know, yeah, great. And this is what makes Land Rover so amazing. This is Meccano set type of mentality that you can literally fix it with anything.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a piece of wire and a bottle of grape juice, and you're good to go.
There's an infamous picture where a double A guy fixed one with a potato.
Oh, uh-huh. I've seen that. Yeah.
And we'd have some stories for you of a I know of a D2 being fixed on the trail that went too fast and water got into the computer, and because the computer had a D1, and there was a little hole in it, and all the mud got in there, and what did Mark you Mark
a toothbrush and a can of WD-40.
Yes, it was my toothbrush and a can of WD-40, and got it back on the road, and it got off the trail. Yeah.
Do you still use that toothbrush?
I do not.
Okay. Yeah, it's those type of stories that go into the book, and to be honest, I'm not selecting images or anything that goes into the book based on how great the story is, because every story that I have interviewed has been great, no matter how big or small. You know, sometimes the smallest things, like, I took my daughter to her wedding in my Series 3 is a great story. Yeah. And those are the things that we all appreciate as Land Rover owners, every single little moment that we drive. Even when you're driving to the shop in your Land Rover is a great moment. And those are the things that I think make this book so great.
Like when I take my 109 to lunch.
Exactly.
Yep. I mean, I just drive 2 miles down the road, and all the people that are looking and staring at me, because, you know, of course, I'm driving on the right-hand side of the vehicle. So what was your second story? You had a second one?
Well, I met this guy in Sweden. His name was Knut. K-N-U-T.
We'd say Knut probably here. But
Knut. Yeah. It is probably Knut. But I'm South African, so I mess everything up. And also another winter story. Ironically, most of these Land Rover stories seem to happen in winter. It had been snowing like crazy where he lived. Everything was snowed in. He had a taxi driver knock on his door and say, "Sir, you need to help me in a hurry. I have a pregnant woman who's gone into labor, and I can't get her to the hospital. The hospital is 20 miles away." He said that he had remembered that a freight train had just gone past, so he knew the train line was open, and he contacted the station master at this town 20 miles away, told him to hold the trains. He's coming down the train track in his Defender and literally got the woman into the hospital by going down the train track in his Defender.
That is a great story.
Nice.
That's outstanding. That's outstanding.
And this is the essence of the book. It's just 100 odd images and stories, short stories, you know, 300 word stories. And it's not only about the story. It's, you know, what Land Rover you drive. When did you get it? How did you get it? Why did you get it? Has it got a name? Why has it got a name? And all these little beautiful things that make Land Rover ownership so awesome.
So how many, you said there's going to be 100 of these, and I assume you're already planning a second book or a third book?
Well, yeah. I think the way things are going is it's going to have to go down the road of volumes, if you want to call it that. There's just too many Land Rovers and too many stories around the world to
miss. I don't know how you could cut it down to just 100.
That's true, yeah.
Money.
Yeah. And
this book is going to cost me roughly $14,000 a shot to print, and I need to keep it to roughly 200 pages, otherwise it's going to be too expensive.
Right, but I don't think you could cut it down to 100. I think you really kind of have to start doing volumes.
Yeah, absolutely.
Which, if it goes well, is only more revenue for you.
And that's the way I would love it to go. You know, this... this chapter of my photographic career, it fills two beautiful voids. One is it helps me with my career as a photographer, which has been going for 14 years, and the other is my love for Land Rover. You know, I'm absolutely hook, line, and sinker. Yeah, and it's just so awesome for it to become a part of my career.
So you take the pictures, you interview the individuals. I assume you visit them in person. So you're flying around the world.
Yeah, well, I'm quite fortunate to have with my photographic work, I travel around the world for various other companies shooting events, which helps me to get around the world to shoot these images. I'll be off to Argentina in March. I will be in the Netherlands in April, in Colombia in May, Brazil in June, July, August, America in September-ish, and somewhere in between that, I've got to get down to South Africa. I've got to get into Europe, which is where I'm living now, and, of course, down to the UAE, which has got some amazing, amazing vehicles and scenery. So I have a lot of travel ahead of me and a lot of photography to do.
Well, let us know when you hit the States, because we'll be glad to talk to you.
We'll hook you up.
Oh yeah, I have a 2-week stay in the States. I have two events that are 3 weeks apart, with, you know, 2 weeks in between, 3 weekends apart. So
when is
my
that?
Trip? It's in September. I don't know the exact date.
Do you know what part of the country?
Yeah, primarily going into South Carolina and ending up in Florida. So it may involve either a road trip from South Carolina to Houston. We have family living in Houston, and I know there's a lot of Land Rovers in Houston, and then a road trip back to Florida. Or it may end up being a jump in a plane and flying somewhere else. I've been in touch with the Land Rover owners, Facebook, one of those guys, and there's some really nice Land Rovers up New York State side. And whilst this can't form part of this trip, I feel very compelled to do a special trip just for that, because I think there's some amazing vehicles there.
There's some amazing vehicles all over the country, actually. We could.
That's so true, and that's the problem.
Yeah, indeed. Because
it's a good problem to have.
It is. You can come to Pennsylvania. You can go up to Vermont. There's some in Maine, Virginia. Certainly, there's a big outcropping of Land Rovers in the Virginia area around D.C. There's an off-road park in North Carolina called Uhari. I've actually been there in my Freelander. So there, I think there's a North Carolina has a good contingent. Of course, Texas has SCAR, which is their Land Rover Club.
Yeah, the South Central area.
South Central something, yeah. And I think there's one developing in Alabama. Oh, you've probably heard about there's a bar in Alabama that is the half of a Series 2.
Yeah, I actually have heard of that, and
Birmingham.
And
Birmingham.
Not too long ago, probably about 2 weeks, I spotted that on Facebook, and definitely has got to be part of the reason to do a trip there. As long as there are some Land Rover owners there that meet and have a beer, and
they do come out. They're everywhere. You'd be surprised. I mean, there's not a lot of us, but we're there. We'll come out. Especially to show off our trucks, of course.
Yeah, exactly.
He needs to swing up to North Carolina and see Will.
Oh, that's true.
I think Will would get a page in the book.
That's true. Will is, we call him the Defender of Defenders. He helped to get some defenders back from the United States government when they were seized.
And
which is a rare event.
And when we say some, I think that was pretty well all.
And
they gave him a defender.
Yeah, that's the best part of the story, is his clients got together and bought him a defender.
And he just came back from Sully Hall.
Yes.
He was at the there for the final production. He just friended me on Facebook. Yeah. So
On my last trip to South Carolina last year, I tried to get some photography done, and I couldn't get it right. But I did meet some people just via Facebook, and there's a guy who does some builds and sells Defenders, Land Rovers, South Carolina. I don't exactly remember where or what the guy's name was, but there's
Himalaya.
A good few people. Sorry?
It's probably Himalaya. He's in Hilton Head.
Oh, Himalaya 4x4?
Yeah. Something like that. I don't remember. I was just, while we were talking, I was just trying to find it in Evernote, but I can't find it. But anyway, yeah, there are a good few people out there, and it definitely, I don't think I'm going to have a problem finding people. It's more a case of finding the time to get things done, because there's a fair chance that I need to spend 3 months working at the Olympics in Brazil, which is going to dig deep into the amount of time I can shoot.
Yep. Well, it could be volume two, could just be the United States itself.
Yeah, exactly.
There you go.
Because you got to get to the West Coast, and you got to get up to Defenders Northwest. He takes some good photography himself. And there's a big outcropping of Land Rovers in California. You have to get to the what we call the Sully Hall Society has the national rally here in the United States, and that's always a good get. Tons of rovers show up for that that's in the West Coast, and especially when they go to Moab. If you've never been to Eastern Utah,
it is
literally otherworldly, and it's a great place to take photographs. That would be there's volume two for you right there. It could just be North America.
Love that. I think I need to come and spend a few months in America.
Sure, you can free space here in Pennsylvania. We'll walk you up.
Fantastic. Looking forward to it.
Yeah. Because hopefully the bells. He'll listen to the show eventually, so I'll have to do a shout out to Graham, and we should make fun of him. But eventually he'll come here, so to the house.
They're actually planning on coming over to Europe, so I'm hoping to put him into the book as well. I hope we cross paths, because he would be an important addition to the book.
Actually, you stand a likely chance of running into him in Brazil. He seems
to
love
that
place.
He just can't seem to be South America. He's in love with that place.
Well, every time he goes one direction, he ends up in Brazil.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
It's like a magnet for him.
So when is the book going to be available?
I'm hoping for release in December.
Of this year?
For Christmas orders.
Okay.
That's the plan. And a lot rests on whether or not Brazil happens. It is a part of me that is looking forward to going to work at the Olympics for 3 months, but there's a part of me that hopes it doesn't happen, because I've got a book to produce, and this book is more important than Olympics to me, to be honest.
And how much do you anticipate the price to be for the book?
I'm looking at a price point of between $40 and $50.
Okay. Now, this is a coffee table format?
Yeah, it's a 30 centimeter by 30 centimeter book. It's a 10-inch book, or 11 inches, 11-inch squared, which when opened up, it's obviously 22 inches by 11 inches.
Right.
And beautiful paper, beautiful photos.
Right. And I assume it's the format that we see on your webpage with a nice big photograph. And,
pretty much.
Yeah, that'll look really nice.
And a bit of text on the side, yeah.
Yeah. I want a signed copy. I'm already requesting my signed copy.
That's fantastic. I'll probably be launching a crowdfunding campaign within 2 to 3 months to try and kickstart this, because it's going to be a fair amount of money invested. And I am fortunate enough that I don't need to use any of this crowdsourced funding for the travel, because it's part of my work as it is. But it's going to be an expensive process to print the book, and that's what we're going to aim for.
Yeah, that high gloss printing isn't cheap.
No.
Well, if you let us know, we'll be sure to plug it and
push it.
I'm sure those of us at the podcast would probably be contributing to it.
I think we would. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I'm really, really hoping to be able to get out to you guys. You know, it's one thing just knowing there's a lot of Land Rovers out there, but when you know that there's Land Rovers and passionate Land Rover owners, and you've actually spoken to them, you kind of are almost obligated to make the effort and get out there and take photos.
Well, and I think the people that listen to our podcast, you know, our numbers aren't super high, but a couple hundred people, and they are around the world, and they by definition, they're passionate, because they're listening to this show and they listen to us blather on every month. So, and
or as I refer to it, a hardcore addict.
Hardcore Energy, very nice. I got an email from the president of Rove because we had some dates wrong.
Who is the president?
I'd have to look it up, Dave. I'm sorry, I forgot. But I got some dates wrong on Mar, but he was listening to an old show. So we're going to have them on the show soon, and they can talk about Mar for 2016. But this, he was listening to an old show from we were talking about Mar for 14, and I'm hoping they'll have them on the show. And so my reason I bring that up is you don't know who's listening, and they're out there, and they're most likely hardcore addicts, Land Rover people. So this is your target audience, I think.
Yeah, I think if there's one thing I could, or two things I could say is one is we've got a link on our website for a little newsletter, which if you want some information on it, just plug in your name into the newsletter, your name and email address into the newsletter form, and we'll keep you posted. And the other thing is, get hold of me. I'm really keen to meet and chat as many Land Rover people as possible. And if there are people out there that have a special vehicle, and if it's possible that I can get to them, I certainly will. It's special vehicles that definitely attract. This last week, I shot a 1977 Series 3 fire wagon with 26 or 23,000 miles on the clock.
Whoa.
Absolute mint condition, beautiful vehicle, and it's just on Facebook, it's just exploded. People are just loving it to bits, and it shows me those special vehicles are out there and people want to see them.
You need to hook up with Graham Aldous. Do you know who that is?
No.
He has a company, does videos, and he did he was invited by Land Rover to do the official Land Rover 65 video, and he's in the UK. Tia Fit is his company name. I'll send you the info. But he got to video and see when Land Rover for the 65 brought all those special vehicles in and had them on display, and he did a video of all that. He'd be a good person to maybe put you onto some of those special vehicles if that interests you. So he's a good resource for that.
We actually drove past a Defender snowplow today.
Nice.
We didn't get to. I actually need to go back and go knock on the guy's door and find out who he is and why he has a snowplow in his front yard. But it's this great big bright yellow Defender with a snowplow in front of it. It's quite crazy.
Sure, sure.
Cool.
Lots of them out there, and they're all beautiful.
I like that. They are all beautiful, are they not? Are they not? So My Land Rover Has a Soul, mylandroverhasasoul.com, and you're also My Land Rover Has a Soul on Facebook. Book is coming out towards the end of the year. You're going to have a crowdfunding site soon. We'll help. Happy to push that for you. So the way to keep in contact with you, I assume, is through the website and the newsletter?
Yeah, definitely. There's contact details on the website. I am sure of that. And if there's not, I will put it up in the next day or so. I'll check my site now. But yeah, contact me through the website, contact me through Facebook, and I will always respond to everyone, but I may not be able to take a photograph of everyone's Land Rover, and unfortunately I'll never be able to do it, and people should just not take it personally.
So what do you drive, and how did you get into Land Rovers?
I drive a P38, Range Rover P38. My first Land Rover was a Discovery 1300 TDI in South Africa.
Good
Loved
choice.
That thing to bits.
We're all salivating.
Hated it as much as anyone hates Land Rovers, but loved it at the same token.
Welcome to
Gave
your
me
addiction.
So much grief with overheating. It was the amount of trouble I've put my family through with that thing was just ridiculous.
This is the definition of the addiction.
Yeah. I'll share you one story on that. I was driving from Johannesburg to Durban on a very, very, very hot summer's day. And one of the telltale signs on a 300 TDI, if you're losing water or if you've got a problem with your heating, with your circulation, it's going to run your vent on hot. And if it gets cold, you got no water in the top of your engine and you got a problem coming. I ran my vents in my whole car on steaming hot on a 35-degree Celsius day for six hours. I wasn't popular, but my vehicle was fine, so that's what it counts.
Yeah, that's we refer to that as the extra radiator.
Yes.
I've been known to use that a lot.
Yeah. That's fantastic. And that's the first piece of advice I give anyone that I know that owns a 300 TDI. So I've had that. I've had the Discovery 3 or the LR3, the V8. It was probably the nicest vehicle I've ever owned. It's just phenomenal. Mm-hmm. We used it like it was intended to be used. And then through Land Rover, I was sponsored to Defender Pumas, both the 2.2, and they were lovely. I really enjoyed them.
More jealousy over here.
But I don't have that relationship with them anymore. Now that I live in the other side of the world, and I'm driving my P38 and loving it. But I think my next purchase will probably be a Discovery 2. I feel slightly uneasy about long trips in my P38, and I know that the Discovery is better than the. Then the Rangey, so I'm going to go over to the Disco.
I love my D2s.
Disco's a new series.
Yeah.
They're so non-electronic. This P38's lovely. It hasn't given me a single bit of trouble other than
don't jinx it by saying that.
Sell it before it does.
It really hasn't. It's been fantastic. Other than it wouldn't start a couple of days ago, and it was glow plugs. It's been great, but I still don't trust it. I feel like I need to go back to a vehicle that I know.
And then for the Landy Festival, folks can. I have a link to the website and that's coming up, and you're going to be helping to organize that again for 2016. Is that?
Absolutely. Yeah. We'll be having guys in South Africa helping us organize it, and we'll be doing a lot of the work remotely and then fly into South Africa to kind of put the polishing touches on it. Nice. The Landy Festival is all about Sheree and myself, my wife and I. You know, we've become the personalities around the event. We know so many people. It's not an event organized by a big fat corporate company. It's an event organized by husband and wife, and that's the way it will always stay.
That's cool. Now the festival has its own website?
Yes.
Yeah, landyfestival.co.za.
Okay.
Or ZA if you're not in the United States.
Yeah, ZA. That's it. Yeah.
That's all right. No worries. We're bilingual here. Well, thanks very much, Craig, for joining us on the show today, and I look forward to seeing the book, and I want number one. Can I get copy number one?
You got it. You asked for it. You got it.
Sweet.
No one else has asked for it.
See? Okay, good. I want copy number one.
So he can pull any book out of the stack and write a number one in the corner, and there you go.
Quiet. Quiet, you. Hopefully, Craig, you can stay with us on the show as we move into our Heritage segment, or do you need to go?
No ways. I want to listen to the Heritage segment.
All right. Well, then hang about, and we'll be right back with the Heritage segment.
On episode 109 of the 4x4 podcast, we talked all about a bunch of new stuff going on. Everything from new tires, throttle bodies, shooting caribou, northern lights, removing salt. Oh man, tons of stuff. Also, in the news segment, we talk about the F-150 getting a diesel motor, Sheldon Creed racing in the Dakar Rally, the Chevy Colorado getting some strong aftermarket support. For aptitude, our off-road aptitude, we talk about where to wheel. It's how you can link up with different off-roaders and find out what's going on in your area. Off-roading 101, we talk about tow points, what they are and what they are not. For our outdoor edible segment, we talk about cooking fuel, what you need to know before you get out there. We do a gear review on the Princeton Tech headlamp that I've been using enough. And we wish you all a happy new year. So, when you're done listening to this episode of the podcast, head over to the 4x4podcast.com/109 and listen to the 4x4 podcast.
Welcome back to number 34 of the Center Steer podcast. And joining us now, as always, for our heritage segment, will be the owner and operator of SeriesParts.com. I think we should push your site too, also, Morgan. Morgan from the Green Mountain State. And this month, you're going to talk chassis, is that right?
Yeah, basically chassis and body. We've gone over pretty much everything else in the Series Land Rovers. So pretty much only thing left. But also, you know, the core of the Series Land Rover, really. It's a fairly classic design that started in 1948. So it's a body-on-frame design, which makes it pretty robust.
As all trucks should be.
Agreed. Yeah. We'll get to a little more of that. it's a fairly heavy chassis with – it's not exactly aluminum, but we'll get to that as well body. So it's a fairly light body on top of a heavy chassis, which – especially at the time in the, you know, late 40s, early 50s, made it to a fairly stable platform. So the chassis itself is a boxed ladder frame. Basically, it's made out of it's got long rails running end to end with some cross members running across the center, hence the ladder design box frame. So it's, you know, made from flat steel stock welded together. You know, a lot of other vehicles tend to use like C-channel and stuff like that, which is, you know, a piece of flat stock that has been bent into sort of a C-shape and runs the entire length of the frame. Now, these are obviously a little lighter and have some other benefits that they don't, you know, hold liquid and stuff like that. But they also tend to have other downsides. So the box ladder frame is probably one of the strongest and simplest to manufacture, and that's why you chose the box frame design originally. It was
actually,
they didn't need any special tooling.
There's another reason for that too. By going to the box, they could use thinner steel, so they could use less material, and steel was hard to get back then.
Exactly. So less tooling, less actual steel used. It works out pretty well. And, you know, in addition to being easy to manufacture and being strong, it doesn't twist. That's one of the things you see in C-channel is that it still can twist pretty easily. You'll see that in a lot of more modern vehicles, especially pickup trucks. You'll notice that they twist a lot between chassis and body, which, you know, can have its advantages, but it's not quite as strong. And, you know, because you're using thinner steel and flat stock, it's actually a pretty easy frame for the enthusiast or the beginner to work on themselves in the field, anywhere. You don't really have to have, you know, anything special in terms of tools or training to make a repair. Obviously, the cons are, you know, relatively heavy. Despite using thinner metal, and it does have a propensity to trap water and dirt, which causes it to corrode a lot faster and less properly maintained.
And given that it's made with thin gauge metal, it rusts through that much quicker.
Very quickly, definitely.
So those of you guys that are in the know, how much thinner is the Series chassis than, say, a Discovery 2? Because I can tell you my Discovery 2, I hate to think what it weighs at this point, because I stuck my finger in one of the holes in the side of the frame and realized that my chassis is completely filled with mud.
Yeah, you might actually be better off drilling some drain holes and flushing it out.
Yeah.
But no, yeah. I've cut apart a 90 chassis, relative modern Defender chassis, and the metal is not that much thicker than a Series truck frame.
So what you're telling me is my custom Series truck frame that I have, I better hold on to, because it's probably...
Well, that one was made with far more steel than any Series truck frame ever was. But it's roughly 14 gauge, so, you know, 75, 80 thousandths of an inch thick, give or take.
And the chassis they made in various wheelbases over the years for the Series Land Rovers. The early ones were 80 inch. They moved to, in terms of the short wheelbase, 86 and eventually to 88. And ever since, they stuck with 88 for the short wheelbase and 109 for the long wheelbase. Obviously, they had some variations here and there for various models. For example, pickups and station wagons are slightly different here and there, But overall, that's what they've stuck to. In terms of the body, while the chassis is steel, the body, only the bulkhead or firewall and the radiator panel are the steel portions of the Series Land Rover. Pretty much everything else is Bermabrite, and Bermabrite is an aluminum and magnesium alloy. It was originally designed to resist corrosion and was developed for use in boats and aircraft. So those are sort of the benefits, the corrosion resistance. Now we'll get to that in a minute, because there's it actually has a propensity to corrode in the use, in that particular use case. And obviously, being aluminum, it's very light. It's fairly easy to work with in many ways. But the big con there is that it is subject to galvanic corrosion. And I'll sort of go into that in a little more detail shortly. But that can cause panels to get eaten away. And at this point, they're hard to replace. It's also difficult to paint. It has to be properly etched prior, as any aluminum does. It's fairly soft, and it does work harden. So the more you bend or hammer it, it gets harder, resists bending, and eventually becomes more brittle.
Unless you know how to anneal it.
Right, unless you anneal it. Interestingly, that was actually one of the original sort of features of Bermabrite, was that you could cold press it into shape, and it would work hardened and hold that shape easily. So kind of interesting how that works. And of course, in the Series Land Rovers, they had many different body styles. So, you know, traditional short wheelbase, basically a three-door. If you had a top on it, you could obviously run them topless. You can fold down the windscreen. You can do soft tops, everything from a bimini top, a three-quarter top, or a full top in terms of the soft tops. They had pickup cabs and van sides. Van sides were basically the three-door in short or long wheelbase. You could get a station wagon, which was five-door in the long wheelbase. They had high-capacity pickups. They had, you know, some of the military spec, like the lightweight air portables, ambulances, forward controls, which were used military and civilian, you know, business use. So it's, as we've mentioned before, like a Mechanoa set, or over here we called them Erector sets, very much whatever you wanted. It can be built on that one platform or easily adapted.
And if you get tired, you can change it.
Right, exactly. Nothing prevents you from, you know, going topless in the summer and putting on a hard top for winter. It's pretty easy, and relatively few bolts.
And the thing is, if you carry half a dozen spanners and a bucket of bolts with you, you can fix it anywhere.
Exactly. And, you know, they used pretty much flat panels for most of the design up until the Series 2. They decided to, you know, make it a little more modern by rounding off the top of the bodies. So, you know, most things can easily be cut from sheet metal and replaced without much tooling. So, you know, it's definitely a platform that continued through the Defender in that way. But the one thing I wanted to sort of go a little more into detail is the galvanic corrosion, because that is really the thing that affects Series Land Rovers most, and at this point are more difficult to keep on top of, because the manufacturer of Bermabrite shut down quite some time ago, so you can't actually get new Bermabrite. We're going to go into a chemistry lesson here. So that's an electrochemical process. Basically, when you have two metals that are in contact and in an electrolyte solution, one metal will corrode preferentially to the other.
Assuming they're not the same metal.
Right, not the same metal, two differing metals.
Dissimilar metals, they call it.
Right, exactly. And an electrolyte is a substance that when, you know, dissolved in water or some other, they call them polar solvents, will create an electrically conducting solution.
Good some example of which is salt water.
Right, exactly. It's pretty much salts, acids, and bases that are soluble.
Road salt and
salt
melted
water
snow.
It is. Yeah, salt water is the big one here. That can be the ocean or, you know, in our area in the Northeast. We love to salt our roads. They've actually decided that to make it salting roads even less expensive, they use salt brine. So they're actually putting a salt solution on the roads instead of just putting the salt on the road and letting it do its work.
Making it more convenient for the process.
Exactly.
But that's also because then the salt stays on the road longer and you get to use less salt. It's not just because when they found that if they just dropped salt, it would spread to it would run off the road and it would not be in the place where it needed to be.
Oh, definitely. And it actually coats your car pretty evenly with salt. More than it used to. So,
oh, of course, the spray is wonderful.
A ready-to-use car dissolver.
Exactly. It's quite helpful. And, of course, the extreme temperatures.
What do you want, clear roads or do you want your car to fall apart in 30 years? Which is it?
Well, the roads are much more fun when they're not clear. So,
I don't want clear roads.
Yeah, I prefer unsalted roads, but, it's America, and I don't necessarily trust the other people on the road, so I understand why they do it. But again, it is they're putting an electrolyte solution on everything. And the electrolyte solution actually allows ions from there's an anodic metal and a cathodic metal. So an anode and a cathode. And so
one becomes more electrically positive and one is more electrically negative.
Right. Exactly.
It's actually the electroplating process in reverse.
Yes, definitely. And so what happens is it allows ions to pass through the electrolytic solution from one to the other, and it makes the anode the one that is,
the anode would be negative.
The anode is the more negative, yes.
It has an N in it, N for negative.
Right. I always forget that rule.
and cathode has a T, T for like a plus sign.
Right. So it'll actually cause it to corrode more quickly. Again, this is an electrolytical electrochemical process. So there does have to be electricity in the process. And so in, a vehicle, generally you're using passing electricity through the body panels to reduce wiring complexity. You just use, like we discussed prior, common these days is a negative ground. So you have electricity running through all the panels in your vehicle. So as it gets wet, gets salt or other electrolytes on the system, it, causes it to corrode more quickly. And
that's not absolutely necessary for the process, mind you, but it does accelerate the process.
It speeds it up, exactly.
Without passing electricity through, you've still got basically a battery because you have two dissimilar metals and the conductive fluid.
Yep, and that was actually one of the things I was going to get to next, that this is basically how a battery works. They are filled with acid, so that's your solution, and they have a cathode and an anode, and they produce electricity. So, and like you said, it's also the reverse of an electroplating process. Now, there's actually an anodic scale that the metals fall on, so that you're trying to figure out which ones are the most negative. And like I said, the most negative ones will suffer the corrosion. They'll sort of be the sacrifice in the process. And
this is why they bolt sacrificial anodes on the side of boats.
Right. Exactly.
And in your water heaters in your house.
For what it's worth, I have an uncle who is a metallurgist who said that I should bolt them to the frames of my Land Rovers.
It can help, definitely. And zinc is one of the most negative, so that's often used as the sacrificial metal. And in fact, when you have something that's galvanized, that is basically zinc-coated. So the zinc will corrode instead of the other metal. Now, if you have something like a galvanized chassis or, on the series Land Rovers, the body cappings are all galvanized and the windscreen frame, the, steel that's underneath there, even if it gets chipped, the zinc will take the brunt of that. Bermabrite, which is aluminum and magnesium alloy, those actually fall between, iron and steel and zinc on the scale. For the most part, in a series Land Rover, you don't have a whole lot of galvanized. It's pretty much all bare steel or painted. And so the Bermabrite, which is the more negative, takes the brunt of that. And because it's a softer alloy, it can corrode pretty easily. But as I said, with galvanizing, that's actually you know, more negative than even Permabright. So one way to get around it is to use, you know, a galvanized frame, galvanized fittings, and that will make sure that the zinc takes the brunt of it.
That's why you, it's the best thing that you can do is assemble it with galvanized bolts, and the worst thing you could do is assemble it with stainless bolts. I've seen that mistake made so many times. People use stainless fasteners to put their truck together thinking, oh, they won't rust and I'll be able to get it apart later. The problem is that is so high on the galvanic scale that it eats the aluminum that it's bolted to.
Guess what they used to assemble my 74 Series 3?
Stainless steel.
Of course they did.
It's very common on the forum threads for people to suggest stainless steel.
Yeah, everybody, oh, go get stainless. It's the way to go. No, it's not. It's the worst thing you can do.
Exactly.
Well, you guys know who put mine together, so.
No comment. Wasn't me.
Best thing you can do is galvanizing. And in fact, there are, just to bring this all sort of full circle or tie it together, there are actually two processes for galvanizing. The most popular is the hot dip galvanizing, where they're actually dipping the steel into molten zinc. You actually can also do electro galvanizing, which is an electroplating with zinc, which is basically the reverse of the process. One of the best things you can do is use galvanizing for fittings and chassis. You can galvanize the bulkhead and the radiator panels. Again, the most common galvanizing is the hot dip, so that will actually warp thin panels, of which the bulkhead is thin, what is it, usually like 20 gauge, I believe.
Depends on which part of it you're talking about. The posts are relatively thick, but the foot boxes are thin.
Right, that's true. Most of the foot boxes and flat panels are fairly thin.
But they'll twist a little bit, but you can usually straighten them out without too much work.
Yeah, definitely. But it's something to be aware of during that whole process.
You will have some fitment issues when you go to put it together.
But yep.
They're not insurmountable.
No, definitely not. But yeah, you can do that. So you can basically galvanize all your steel. You know, some people will still use, you know, plastic washers between their metal washers against the panels just to, you know, further protect. If you're using all galvanized fittings, it probably doesn't really matter, but can't really hurt. In terms of repairing Permabright panels, there are some essentially solders, some filler materials that you can use to patch holes. I actually don't have the one on my list that I had hoped to note, but I believe it was tested recently by the Ben from Fun Rover. He used it to test on some of his panels. I think we talked to him about that last month. It does work. You have to be very careful when doing any repairs on Permabright that you don't overheat it. It is aluminum. It will melt extremely quickly if you go over temperature.
Yeah, and when it melts, it doesn't just like deform. It just ceases to be.
Right. It's gone.
It evaporates?
Well, as quickly as you can think about it, all of a sudden there's this little bit of metal junk on the floor and a big gaping hole where your panel used to be. And it's not like it sags and runs. It just like poof.
Okay. Turns liquid or plasma.
Yeah, it's immediately a liquid. It's pretty crazy. As we said before, you can anneal Permabright, which is, you know, heating it slightly carefully. I believe the original suggestions are to use a torch set on a low temperature and to like rub a bar of soap on the panel, and once you've heated it so much that your soap has melted, that's it. Don't go beyond that. But that allows you to get around work hardening. If you're doing patching, like I said, you can use fillers. You can actually get fillers produced for the right mix to TIG weld on Permabright. So that's, some people do that. I honestly wish it was a little more common. And if you have any old Permabright panels, you can cut patches from those and sort of stitch them back together, weld them back together, TIG welding or using other fillers. But that's pretty much it, and why it's best to protect your Permabright panels as much as you can.
A lot of people I've seen that will do field fixes just use rivets.
Right.
Mechanically
exactly.
Connect them and call that good enough. And the nice thing about a series truck is if it's beat up and torn, who cares? It looks good that way.
Yeah, and you know, rivets don't look out of place. It works pretty well if you have a hole like that, but if you have areas where panels fit with other panels or attached to the body, which obviously are the points where the galvanic corrosion attacks the most, you got to find some way to patch those, probably with something a little stronger than...
Just covered up with checker plate. You know, it's fine.
Totally. But in terms of, like, you know, general body and frame upgrades, you can actually get new galvanized chassis. That's what I got for my series Land Rover. I believe that the only company producing them at this point is probably Richards. There was one other company who now only makes Defender and other Land Rover chassis.
You talking about Marsland?
Oh, yeah. You know, maybe I have it backwards. I can't remember off the top of my head. But yeah, Marsland and Richards were the two. And I think it is Marsland who only does Defender and other now.
That's a new development. As of a couple of years ago, they were still making series truck chassis.
Yeah, it was in the last few years. Okay. Again, I could have it backwards that Richards is the one that is no longer. But
as I recall,
it's always an option to find a decent one or patch one up and then get it galvanized.
So. Absolutely. Galvanizing is usually done by weight. It's more of an industrial process. So you'll find that common in industrial areas. I know that around us, it's hard to get galvanizing in Vermont. But you go down into like Massachusetts and New Jersey, and you can find places who will do it. It's by weight usually. So you just sort of bring a chassis and as many other parts as you want. Pay for the galvanizing and you're done.
The hard part is not necessarily just finding a galvanizer, but finding one with a tank big enough to dip the frame.
That is actually true for the frames, yes.
The bulkhead and the radiator panel are generally a no-brainer, but frames take a big tank.
It's true.
You have to dip it all at once? You can't like dip one side and then turn it around?
No, not so much.
You want an even coat at the same time?
Yeah, they have to make sure they actually do a chemical dip first to remove all purity or impurities, and then they do the hot dip. You also have to make sure that there are no air pockets that can be created in the, whether it's a chassis or, you know, bulkhead or anything like that. So you'll often be drilling extra holes to make sure that you can dip it without air pockets.
Yeah, you actually want some drains so that you don't end up filling the frame with zinc.
Yes. That makes it much heavier.
Is zinc noticeably heavier? Does it add considerable weight?
Well, the point is if you turn a tube into a solid bar.
Right, no, I get that, but how much heavier is zinc compared to, you know, the Berman Bright itself? Is it double the weight? Is it
you're talking about steel at this point.
Steel, sorry.
Berman Bright, right. But it's, I don't know. It's there is a difference, but
it's noticeable.
Yeah. I know that I've read about people that have had their frames dipped and they didn't drill the extra holes. Later on in life had accidents and they went ahead and cut the frame open and found out that their frame was half filled with zinc. So
that's got to add a couple hundred pounds
at least.
Yeah, okay. That's the end, which then of course will affect your mileage and all other issues. Okay. That's what I was
looking for. But you're driving a Land Rover.
Totally.
Who cares?
At that point, in some ways, maybe every pound helps.
Yeah.
And at least it's in the chassis, so it's, you know, fairly low sprung weight. But
right.
One safety tip on galvanized metal is that it is highly toxic to breathe the fumes if you are heating or welding on it. Do not try to use, a cutter or a welding equipment on any galvanized metal without first stripping the galvanizing off the zinc coating.
Important safety tip.
Yeah, I've been there. It's nasty stuff.
Yeah, it's anything from, you know, acute sickness to death. It can be deadly. So
important safety tip.
Yep.
Definitely. You can actually also get there's a lot of people who do hybrid coilover conversions, either modifying a chassis or, getting a Range Rover chassis, doing something like that. Lots of options. If you're doing that, obviously you're doing something highly custom, so whatever you got to do, you're going to have to do some research and measuring and planning. That's always one to, you know, improve suspension at the same time you're improving your chassis. There are some other small improvements you can make to, you know, the series. Defender door seals are popular. They seal much better than the series 3 door seals or Series 2.
And they're a lot cheaper.
A lot cheaper, yep, definitely. The heat is not great in Series Land Rovers, nor the defroster vents. So a lot of people would go with heated windscreens or new heaters, various options there.
Heated originally. Seats.
And heated seats, absolutely.
$12 off of Amazon Prime. Amazon Basic heated seats, $12. Done.
Yes, we should definitely always
best thing I ever
that.
Did.
Yep.
I saw a post the other day on Facebook that some guy set his dog a light or
really?
something stupid. Someone's cheap heated seat caught a light in his Defender.
Ouch! Yeah, that's horrible.
His dog got injured a bit, and there was some kind of a cushion on top of the seat as well, and that got burnt. And
That could be part of the problem.
Yeah,
yeah. That's the problem with any heated seats like that. You are producing heat from electricity. If you have a short, things can go wrong.
Yeah, and invariably cheap is cheap.
Yes,
true.
In terms of other upgrades, some popular door upgrades are the Rocky Mountain door tops, where you get improved double sliding windows for the Series Land Rovers. Obviously, you can just take the door tops off if you're in such a climate. They also make soft windows, door tops for the Defenders, which will fit, all sorts of things like that you can do. Insulation and sound deadening is popular. Again, it's going to add weight, but, you know, Bermamite bright panels, aluminum can.
What? What'd you say? What?
I know, insulation, what's that?
I can't hear you. Sorry, the engine's running.
I got to say, along those lines, the molded rubber floor mat that they make for those is a phenomenal upgrade in terms of noise and comfort.
Yes. And that's
not cheap, but it's nice.
No, it's not cheap. It is very nice. And that probably the same one that you're speaking of also covers the seat box, which obviously also helps.
Yeah, it's 3 pieces. It's a little piece for the over the transmission on the bulkhead, and then it's the main floor, and then there's a separate piece for the seat box.
Yep.
And it's heavy grade rubber over top of acoustic foam, all molded to fit.
Exactly, and those are great. You know, Land Rover originally made some, you know, felt that you could install for insulation and then put rubber over that. Obviously, a Series Land Rover is probably going to get wet, especially if you take it, you know, off-road or anything like that. Those newer insulation and sound deadening kits are much more waterproof. So much better to get something like that. As usual, because there were so many body styles, you can just swap over most things that you want to make it the way you would like. So you can sort of pick and choose. You know, there's the usual bumpers and roof racks and such that you can install. One note on the bumpers is that the bumpers on the Series Land Rovers actually bolt through the ends of the chassis rails. So it's actually a very strong connection, which is often not the case on some other off-road vehicles.
Yeah, the connection is far stronger than the bumper itself.
Yes, definitely.
I've seen a few series truck bumpers that are V-shaped from being pulled on.
Yes.
I saw one come off.
Really?
At the connection point or somewhere else? What do you mean it came off? The bumper came off from the chassis itself? Because it wasn't...
I think it took part of the chassis with it, too.
Okay.
The frame horns are a classic place for rust, so
yeah, they're
not entirely
the lowest,
surprising if it wasn't...
They're the lowest point, so the muddy water collects there.
Definitely.
And they neglected to put a drain right next to it.
It's true.
And the drain would get plugged anyways.
Well, eventually they make their own drain.
That's right.
Yes. And yeah, you can get repair portions for the frame horns there and the rear cross member. That's the sort of other common failure on the chassis. And get replacement parts for all of those from numerous manufacturers. So a lot of that stuff can just be cut off and welded back on.
Or if you know a good fabricator, he can just make that stuff for you.
Absolutely. Or like I said, if you have the right gauge or pretty close gauge, as long as at least thicker, you can just cut it and weld it yourself. I've seen many people do that. But yeah, that's pretty much it. There's a lot there. And like we said, it's sort of a Meccano set. Build what you want, pair what you want, works well. It's a good platform. And that's sort of where the Defender got its roots for its excellent platform.
Yeah, I think, you know, when you chat about this Meccano set sort of side of things, it's the one thing I really, really hope this new Defender is going to do, and that's have this bolt-on, bolt-off type of makeup. I don't think it's going to be that way. I think we're going to unfortunately have to suck it up and take the new panels and integrated chassis and all the rest of it. But I hope they do something along those lines.
They're going to be welded. They're going to be stuck together. They're going to be glued. You're not going to get bolt-on.
Probably won't be modular either.
No.
All the things that make a Defender a Defender.
Yeah. They're probably going to be even plastic on there. Can you imagine?
Doesn't deserve the Defender name.
Freelander had plastic body fenders in the front.
It should be called the Pretender.
The Pretender.
It'll be what it'll nice. Be. We shall soldier on.
Exactly. Yep. Exactly.
Yep.
Well, and truth be told, how many of us are going to go out and buy a brand new one? That's what I thought. I'd be the first one probably to get one of the group here.
And then I'm going to make you follow me down the trail.
I'll do that. I'll do that. I might lead the trail.
I wouldn't bet on it.
Thanks, Morgan, for this month's Heritage segment. What do we have on tap for next month?
I haven't decided. We'll probably have to move on to other vehicles like the Range Rover Classic or the D1.
We could have accessories.
Possibly. We could totally do accessories. Absolutely.
Maybe the audience will tell us where to go next. If you have an idea for starting our next Heritage segment, send it in. Let us know.
Yes, because listener contributions have been so useful to us in the past.
They have. Well, we're working on it. We're working on listener contributions.
I think we've identified every listener contribution we've gotten. So
we do. Yeah. We do listen and identify yes, every listener.
Both of them.
We've had more than two. Thanks for listening today to the 34th edition of the Center Steer Podcast. I want to thank our panelists. Thank you for joining us, gentlemen.
And hey, if any of you happen to make it out to the main winter romp on February 12th through the 14th, please stop by and say hi. I will be wheeling with everyone out there.
Look for Dave, and you'll be driving what, Dave?
I'll be driving my blue 99 D2.
And are you towing it up?
I'll be towing it with my very orange Ram. So it'll be hard to miss.
Say hi to Dave, and I'm going to give Dave something to the first person that goes up to Dave and says, listen to the Center Steer Podcast. We'll give him a prize. So do that. Please stop and say hi to Dave. We're going to give a prize to the first listener that goes up to you.
Damn, I think I need to go.
And I also want to thank our guest all the way from South Africa by way of Ireland and soon to be in Scotland is Craig from MyLandRoverHasASoul.com. Thanks for joining us today, Craig.
The confused South African. Absolute pleasure. It was great meeting you guys.
You're not the first confused South African that we've met. Yes, yeah. Graham, we're talking about you. There we go. I finally got my shot
in. Is that an oxymoron?
I remind you that we're part of the 4x4 Radio Network. I invite you to go out and check some of the other fine podcasts on the network, the J Word, Muddy Microphone, and the 4x4 podcast. Dan is now up in Alaska, and you can check out some of his exploits going on up there. We're approaching our third anniversary, and I invite you to go out and check out our website for links to all the discussion we've had today, the various stories that's in the show notes. Like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter. But I think the best thing you can do, especially if you enjoy the podcast, is to tell your friends. Word of mouth is probably our best advertising. We enjoy doing the show pretty much just because we enjoy Land Rovers, nothing else. Does the podcast have a soul?
Got a soul.
Craig says it has a soul. Oh, and Craig, you're officially declared friend of the show.
Awesome.
I hope you enjoyed listening to this month's show, where we'll talk to you again in a month's time to talk more about Land Rovers. And now, to honor the Defender, 67 seconds of silence. The Center Steer theme song, Sunset Rider by the Tritons, is available from Nivio's Music Alley. Check it out at music.nivio.com.
bring a Dodge Ram to a Land Rover meeting?
It's what I use to tow my Land Rovers.
Welcome to America, pal.